And good morning. It's just after 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. And Kevin McKinley is with us today for another hour of On Your Money. And as always, we've got lots to talk about. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money. Well, Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Gene.
Well, boy, you got my attention with that. You know, when I hear that song in the background, it reminds me of a long time ago, the 1970s. I'll just kind of leave it there.
But, oh, if old Gene could talk to young Gene and tell him what you know now.
Yes, young Gene might be in a better position in any number of ways that we don't need to get into now. But we're talking about money this hour. And, you know, the month of June has a lot of special ceremonies. Of course, the graduations that we're talking about from high school or technical college or university, wherever you might be. And we're going to be talking this hour about money and some life wisdom to those who are taking part in those ceremonies. And, Kevin, where are we going to start with that?
Let's start with those people who are getting their diplomas, hopefully from high school or some institute of higher education. The good news is you're done. The bad news is you are probably going to either be unemployed or underemployed for at least the time being, and you have some very big decisions to make. And if you choose wisely, us old people are going to tell you what you should be doing right now so you have less regrets and more success over the rest of your life.
Choosing wisely. Yeah, that's good. That's a good place to start. Let's start with the high school graduates. What advice do you have for those folks?
Well, as much as it might seem tempting, don't let your summer go to waste. About a quarter of younger people are unemployed right now. That's 25% versus 14% of 7 years ago, and compares to the adult overall unemployment rate of about 7.6%. Go work for somebody, anybody who will hire you. And if you can't find the right job for yourself, go work for yourself. Mow lawns, take some babysitting jobs. There's lots of older people in your neighborhood who could use a young person like yourself to perform some tasks for a good wage. And if you can't find a job or you still have some extra time left over after your job, volunteer. Go to volunteermatch.org to look for different places that you can be of help in your community and not only learn something, gain some valuable experience and some contacts, and something you might be able to put on a resume at some point down the road. If you do have an opportunity to take some classes on your way to a higher education degree, please take those classes now, because anything that you can earn will save you or your parents some money. If you go to college, you might want to spend some time looking for some scholarships at fastweb.com. There are several $1 billion of scholarships that go unawarded every single year, and you can find those at fastweb.com. Now, if you are going to college or you're considering it or going on to some form of higher education, if you're into it, go to it. But if you're not, don't be afraid to take a semester off or take a lighter load or even take a year off until you're ready to go. One of the biggest wastes of time that many 18-year-olds undertake is they go to school at some form of higher education, and they're just not ready for it. They're not ready for the time. They're not ready for all the distractions and how to ignore them. And it turns out to be a big waste of time for their money. So there's nothing wrong with taking some time off to figure out what you want to do when you grow up.
All right, so that's the advice for the high school grads. But what about those who are leaving institutions of higher education?
Sadly, the best advice is, again, to take any job you can get. The employment rate for college graduates, recent college graduates, is much better now. The unemployment rate is down to 7.9% right now. That's down from close to 10% a few years ago. But if you can get any kind of foot in the proverbial door with an employer offering your eventual dream job, take it. I don't care if it's in the mailroom or if it's in the copy room. One of the most successful people I know got his job many decades ago by telling the employer, after the interview was over, say, look, I want this job. I want to get paid eventually, but I would work here for free. And with some of the internship issues coming out of the courts lately, you got to be a little careful about that. But that's a way to demonstrate just how passionate you are about working at that particular place. Once you get into that door, you work on building your brand, which sounds like some kind of marketing gimmick. But your brand is what people think of you when they first think of you. Get to work early, leave later, and always assume that someone is watching every single thing that you do and listening to every single thing you say. So if you're on Facebook during company time or you're speaking badly about your boss, just assume that that's all going to get back to someone who holds your future in their hands and has lots of other people who are applying for your job. In your personal life, you should live as cheaply as you possibly can. Don't jump just from some cruddy college house or apartment or dorm room into your own place. Try to share a place with some roommates and then pay off your debt as slowly as you possibly can. Save your cash until you get a year's worth of living expenses set aside and you're maxing out your at-work retirement plan.
Yeah, I want to spend a second on that because that sounds really counterintuitive. I mean, it sounds better, more logical to pay it off more quickly, but you're saying no, save some money and take some time.
That's right. The cash is way more important than the little bit of interest charge that you're probably going to be paying by not paying the debt off sooner. And since your position in life and in the workplace is probably a little tenuous, you don't know what you're going to be doing 5 years from now, keeping that cash set aside to cover any emergency, whether it's something you choose, maybe the job just isn't for you, or you're laid off or you're even fired because you didn't listen to our advice about not going on Facebook at work. It's good to have that cash on hand to protect yourself from a financial emergency if you should need to make a change.
Okay, so we've talked about high school graduates, some of those who are leaving institutions of higher education. But what's the one piece of financial advice that you would give to those people who are entering, I guess, what we would call adulthood?
Sure, in name only in some cases. But the single most important factor in determining, in my opinion, not only your success, but also your happiness with your work life is what you spend every single month. It's less important than what you make, what you save, how you invest, but what you spend. The less money you spend, the easier it is for you to maintain financial independence and become financially independent. And as you will find out very soon, it's easier to spend less than it is to earn more.
And what June celebrants are you going to be addressing next week?
We will be discussing the other people going through a big ceremony, newlyweds. June is the biggest month for weddings throughout the year, but also many more during the spring and summer. And we think that other couples might learn something as well.
All right. It sounds good, by the way, for listeners out there who would like to join in. If you'd like to give Kevin a call with a question or a comment, here's our phone number. It is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our email is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. And this reminder that Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. All right, it's time to reach into the On Your Money mailbag, and we've got this letter fresh from the post office here. May wrote it, and it says, I've recently been sent a C-share letter and prospectus receipt to sign indicating that I've been advised of the higher operating and expenses related to my Class C shares. Please elaborate on the differences between Class A and Class C shares. Kevin, I have no idea what May just said.
I'm glad to hear that, Gene, because I really need this gig. So this is a matter of how and when you pay the sales charge that the advisor and the firm deducts from your investment. The money goes to the advisor and the firm, certainly not all of it. Advisors usually get about 40% of the commission that you pay. The rest is split among the firm for office, administrative help, the nice building, the coffee in the waiting room, etc. With an A share, there's a higher upfront cost. It's usually about 3 to 5% of the investment amount. But then you pay lower fees, both in terms of ongoing internal expenses of the mutual fund, and the advisor also gets less. The advisor typically gets about 0.25% per year from the fund, paid from the fund company to the advisor and the firm every single year. So it's just 25/100ths of 1%.
Okay, there's the Class A, and what about the Class C share?
Now, the C-share, there's no upfront cost. Generally, the advisor gets paid 1% of the deposit amount, and then if you pull the money out in the first year, there's a 1% surrender fee. However, there are higher expenses because the advisor and the firm typically get 1% of the firm of the money from the mutual fund company every single year versus the 0.25% that is typically the case with the A shares. So the advisor gets more money from the mutual fund company, and you'll find that C shares earn less money compared to A shares on a given year's basis because more of the money is going to the advisor and the firm from the fund company and your fund.
All right. So at the end of it all, do you have a preference?
Well, I'm a little biased because the way I've set my practice up, I'm a fee-based advisor, and I think there are a lot of great real no-load funds like Vanguard, et cetera, exchange-traded funds out there. But if you're picking between the two, I still prefer the C-share because it offers the flexibility that either if the advisor decides, you know what, this fund isn't right, let's move to a different one. After a year in the C-share fund, you can move to a different fund with no cost, no surrender charge whatsoever. Or if you decide you don't like the advisor, the advisor has a vested interest in keeping you happy because as long as he or she is serving you, he or she gets 1% of the money that you have in that particular C-share mutual fund. So you should use an A-share if you're investing larger amounts. Typically, A-shares give a discount the more you go over, say, $100,000 or $250,000. Or if you have a good relationship with the advisor and you know the advisor is going to be there regardless, even though there's not as much of a financial incentive for you, that's okay too.
All right. And let's thank you for that advice, and hopefully it will help some folks out. In the meantime, we've got some listeners who would like to join in. Here's our phone number, by the way. It's 800-642-1234. Don't forget you can also send us emails. That address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. As promised, we've got a listener here who is waiting to join us, and it is Jane, who is with us from, it looks like, Maple. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right, Jane. Well, you're on the air with Kevin.
Yeah, I have a question. So back to the students thing again. So let's say you're a student. You've been out of school, been out of college for about 7 years. You've got a job that's got, you know, some decent benefits, but you really aren't going to go up the ladder because it's the kind of situation in which you're only qualified for other jobs of that type. Do you recommend going back to graduate school, which is very expensive, and getting a master's? Or at this point, is a master's really not going to get you any more than what you have right now?
This isn't just a hypothetical question, is it, Jane?
No, it's not.
No, it's not. It doesn't sound like. Is this you for whom you're asking, or is it someone else?
No, it's not.
An interested party.
Someone I know.
An interested party. Yeah, I'd say if it's a younger person in his or her 20s or 30s and they are the person is living a very frugal life, as cheap as possible, going back and getting the master's is fine. And it's actually, and sometimes sadly, necessary for many jobs to go back and get that. However, I would do it only if you said, you know what, there's a task or a position or an occupation I would really love to do. Where I think people get in trouble with graduate degrees is they incur the lost earnings of the time that they spend going to pursuing that degree, plus all the extra cost. And then if there's not some big guaranteed job right there with this huge commensurate increase in salary, they're disappointed. And if they know the situation in the field well enough to understand that even once they get out with that degree, you know, there's a chance that they might not get a job right away, they might not get the dream job they have, and they still say, yeah, I want to do this, it's not for the money, it's for my own professional advancement and what I'd be enjoying, then yes, I would say go ahead and do it. But if they're just doing it solely as a financial investment, then I would say maybe hold off for a few more years. People are working into their 60s now, and it's not just because they have to. Some people want to, and part of that is because career arcs aren't the same as what they were 30 or 40 years ago, where people get out of high school and go to work at the mill, or they get out of college and go to work at some big company. Lots of people change hats several times over their lives now, and that's going to be true more so in the future. So delaying going to grad school or getting a master's degree is not the end of the world if it's not what the person really wants to do at this very moment.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Jane, thanks so much for the call. And Kevin, you know, in this economy, that has to be a question that not just Jane, but a lot of people are asking.
That's right. And if they can incur the debt or the cost, if someone else is willing to pay for it, what I really like is when people say, you know, it would normally take me 2 years to go full time, but I'd have to quit work and somehow support a family, so I can't do that, or even support myself. What I'd rather have them do is take longer to get the master's degree, go part-time, and don't go all full bore at once, because that's when it can be not only stressful financially, but also for a lifestyle. You have to give up all this time for this big bet on your career. So I'd much rather have people do it slowly rather than in a hurry. Trust me, you're going to live a long time, and you're going to have a long time to earn back all that time and work. So don't be in a hurry to get in and get out of grad school if you can help it.
I like your optimism, Kevin. We're going to be taking a break, and when we return, we will head back to the phones. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Joy Cardine. It's On Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I see.
It's 24 minutes past 8 o'clock on Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with Kevin McKinley. I'm Gene Purcell, here for Joy Cardine. A little bit later on in the program, stick around, because we're going to be talking about how you can save money on service and maintenance for that car you're driving around. Right now, let's head back to the phones, and Jerry joins us from Kenosha. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. I'd like to ask you about I have a Roth CD coming due soon at a bank. I do not want to renew it at the present bank rate. May I take a check from them and reinvest it elsewhere when I decide where to go with it?
You mean what you're asking is can you cash out of the Roth IRA and then do something else with the money at some point?
And keep it within the Roth, yes.
That's a good question. What I would suggest is you actually do leave it at the original institution and see if they have a Roth IRA money market account. Typically, an institution will probably, unless you tell them not to, they'll roll that money over into like a new CD for you within the Roth IRA. Ask them, say, if I don't want that new CD, but I also don't want to move the money, can I just leave it in some kind of, you know, money market account within that Roth IRA? If they say no, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and if they don't offer a money market Roth, can I just take a check and walk out the door?
You can, but you'll pay taxes on the earnings from the Roth. The contribution portion of that Roth IRA is tax-free. You don't pay any taxes on it when you cash out of it. And if you're over age 59 and a half, you probably can pull the whole thing out with no taxes whatsoever. But the bad news is once you pull it out, it's done. You can't put it back into a Roth IRA someplace else if you put it into your own checking account.
Oh, so I better be careful if I take a check, even though I reinvest it a week later in another Roth, they won't allow it to be a Roth anymore, huh?
Highly likely. What you want to do, Jerry, is you want to find a new place to put the Roth that suits your needs and then have the old institution electronically transfer the money from them to the new place. And then that way you don't take custody of it, and that way it remains in the shell of the Roth IRA, and you won't have to worry about trying to get the money back into the new place in the form of a check.
All right. I sure hope they offer a money market Roth. I will go see them as soon as the CD is due.
All right, Jerry.
Thank you very much.
You bet, Jerry. Thanks for the call. And Kevin, you know, Jerry said one thing. He said, I better be careful. And I think that's probably good advice for everyone. You know, I mean, it sounds flip, but I'm being serious here. You know?
No, absolutely right. There are so many details that in all these transactions, and they're apparent to people who are in the industry. But a lot of us have money, and a lot of us don't deal with this stuff on a day-to-day basis. And it's not even a case of where they're trying to catch you. It's just that there's so many little things that if you make a small mistake, there's no turning back from it. It's not the end of the world, but it can be very damaging for your finances.
Vincent joins us now from Janesville. Hi.
Hi. I'm a college student, and I was wondering, I'd read once or twice or heard that money market mutual funds are a good alternative to savings accounts through banks. Just in that they might have like a higher interest rate or something like that. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestions for anything for like these liquid funds that I'm not going to be holding on to for very long, or if you had any thoughts on that.
Sure, Vincent. Well, congratulations, being a college student with money to invest rather than debts you're trying to repay. So good for you. The money market accounts at one time were better than checking accounts, but due to a zero interest rate environment and the expenses that money markets incur to manage your money, that's not the case anymore. And I think you're lucky to get a tenth of a percent interest on it. And regardless of the amount of money of which we're speaking, that's really not going to be a whole lot. So I would rather have you put it into some kind of interest-bearing account that is insured. And that can be at a bank or a credit union. And typically, if the balance is a little larger, they might have something called like a smart saver account or whatever, if it's more than $10,000 or $25,000. And they'll pay you a little more. But right now, even if you put it in like a 10-year treasury bond, you're only going to get a couple percent interest for it. So we can't expect money market and other short-term accounts to pay anything simply because they have to go out and reinvest the money in very safe, very liquid investments. And right now, very safe, very liquid investments pay close to nothing. So you should worry in this situation, Vincent, more about the return of your money rather than the return on your money.
All right, Vincent, good luck. And Mark is with us now from Menasha. Hi.
Hi. Kevin, first of all, thank you for doing this show. It's a wonderful show, and I'm a dedicated listener.
You're the one. Good. Thank you.
Thank you. So the question that I had was, I'm under 40 years old, and as I've been diversifying my portfolio, obviously, you know, mutual funds, ETFs, but then for about the last, 2 to 3 years, I've been adding MLPs into my non-taxable accounts, traditional and Roth IRA. And my question for you is, what are your thoughts on using MLPs as an investment vehicle in a retirement account?
Sure. MLPs are master limited partnerships, and you are basically a limited partner in this operation. Oftentimes, they are tied to oil and energy exploration, but not necessarily. They typically have a payout when times are going good, like they have been, that's much higher than what CDs and other types of bonds and other income-oriented vehicles pay. It could be 6 to 8% in some cases. There are two issues with these. One is you're basically owning a business for better or for worse, and it's a business that is almost required to kick out all of their cash and net earnings as income. That's great when things are going well, but when it's not, they may kick out nothing, and the value of the shares can drop precipitously. You know, 30 or 40% would not be a surprise. It hasn't happened a lot in the past, but it can happen in the future. So that's one thing I would be concerned about. And the second one is for other people who are considering these can be tax paperwork nightmares because of special forms that need to be filed and the way that the distributions are calculated in terms of who owes what for the taxes. And so they can be good investments if you're comfortable with accepting a higher amount of risk for the higher income, and if you're very comfortable manipulating all of the paperwork that's required to file a taxes. You can shelter that somewhat by keeping that money in Roth IRAs or IRA tax-deferred accounts. That can mitigate somewhat, but it still can be a lot of work to figure out, to make sure you're getting what you're supposed to. And so I would be cautious with them, but I'm not afraid of them at all for a small portion of someone's portfolio.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Mark. Thanks so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
It's time for the Smart Assets segment of On Your Money. And so we're going to be talking about an issue that's in the news today. A government watchdog agency says that some banks are hurting customers who are using overdraft protection on their checking accounts. How can that be? What's the deal with that, Kevin?
Well, it will be an ongoing saga in this low and zero interest rate environment. Just like investors are having a hard time making money on their money, banks and credit unions are too. So the institutions are trying to find new ways to generate revenue and profits. And what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau found is that some people were paying a lot more than they should for this particular coverage, especially compared to if they weren't going to take the coverage at all.
And so how does this service work?
The customer must opt into this overdraft protection. Formerly, some institutions had kind of a backdoor way of getting people into this, saying, hey, don't never not sign here, and then you're not going to ever never be in this. Now you have to say, yes, I really want this kind of protection. And then if you write a check or run a debit card that is bigger than the balance in your account, normally it would be NSF, non-sufficient funds. But now the bank or the credit union covers it if you have this protection, but it charges you a fee. And the fee can run anywhere from $25 to $35 or more. And then you have to pay not only to replenish the account for the amount that that you've overdrawn, but you have to pay the fees on top of it.
So what kind of problems does the agency have with this practice?
Well, let's be fair to the institutions here. This is really a very short-term emergency loan, and there is a risk that the customer may overdraw the account and then not have enough money to pay it back, and the bank has to pursue it and go after them. And if you do, let's say, write a check or use a debit card or something, then and the institution to which you're writing it, like a restaurant or something, can't cash the check for you, you can get in much bigger trouble than just $35 in fees. But what the CFPB said is that the fees add up, and some institutions purposely change the way they calculate the fee, meaning they'll see like four or five things coming into the account at once, and they'll see that there's a big withdrawal that will deplete the account, and then they'll put that one in first and then sequence it so the smaller ones come in afterwards so that they can get a fee on every single one rather than paying the three or four that they could pay and only covering the big fee. So there's the problem with the ordering of transaction. There's a problem with fees on top of fees. And then finally, if the person can't pay those extra fees on top plus cover the balance, the bank or the credit union rightfully closes the account. But that can end up being a big black mark on a credit report for people who usually can't afford any type of negative marks whatsoever.
Yeah, a big black mark that could follow you around for a while. So what tips do you have for people who want to avoid trouble with overdrafts and fees?
If you do have this protection, I don't mind this protection at all. I think it can be a good idea. It can be helpful. But make sure you know the terms of it. Check with the institution. And when they send you those little thin slips with tiny writing on saying we may be changing the terms of your agreement, read it. And if you can't read it, ask for a bigger print version. And if you don't understand it, ask for them to explain what the new terms are. And if you don't like the terms, shop around. You might find a better deal at smaller local banks or credit unions in your area. And finally, if you're putting money other places, like in a CD or something, again, interest rates are so low right now, you're really not costing yourself by sliding it back into your checking account and keeping a higher balance in there so you don't run the risk of an overdraft.
Yeah, and the only thing I think I would add to that is, you know, when you read them, you should read them again, because, you know, I've read those things, believe it or not, and I never quite get it the first time.
Yeah, and usually I fall asleep. Even it could be in the middle of the day. I'm halfway through the paragraph and my head hits the desk, and a half hour later I wake up with a string of drool tracing down toward my face there. And I go, oh, yeah, that's right. I was reading my agreement with my credit union.
Oh, good. Thanks for the visual there, Kevin. That was terrific. If you got a question or a comment for Kevin, here's our toll-free phone number. It is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, onyourmoney@wpr.org. We've got an email from Chris who asks this question. Can you put money into a Roth IRA for your grandchildren, or must I retain it before taking the money out and then giving it to them?
That's a great question, Chris, and congratulations on being a benevolent grandparent. Yes, you can put money into a Roth IRA specifically for a grandchild, but the grandchild must have earned income on their own that represents the same or more of what the actual deposit is. Meaning, if you have a two-year-old, let's say, who doesn't have any earned income, doesn't have a job, first of all, ask that two-year-old why he's laying about the house
exactly
so much. He's just a total drag on the family here.
Second
of all, you can open up your own Roth IRA, and you keep control of it. And at some point, if you want to pull the money out, you can, and give it to the grandchild at that time. But if you do pull it out, you can pull the contributions out tax-free, no taxes or penalties whatsoever, when you withdraw the contribution portion, and the good people at the IRS let you designate all the withdrawals as contributions until you've matched that up with the amount of money you've put in. Then and only then may you pay taxes on the earnings portion. But even then, if you're older than 59 and a half, even the earnings will be tax-free as well. So, yes, you can open it up for a grandchild, but the grandchild has to have an earned income. And once you make a deposit for the grandchild into her Roth IRA, it's her money. She gets to do with it whatever she wants. Smart grandchildren will only do smart things with the money because they know there might be more there after this original deposit. But keep in mind, once she becomes an adult in name only, she gets to do whatever she wants with the money you've put in there.
All right. We've got a call now. Gary is with us from Eau Claire. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about your bank overdraft charges for checks. I use a check card, and the bank still charges, even though I have coverage for overdraft fees. I still get an overdraft fee. It's small, like maybe about $5, but I still get it.
You mean, Gary, they charge you when you actually make an overdraft, or they just charge you for having the protection?
No, they charge me when I have an overdraft.
Okay. Yeah, and you're only paying $5?
I think it is, but I have overdraft protection.
Yeah, usually that's the issue at hand here. And if you're actually only paying $5, I have a bunch of people who are probably emailing and calling us right now saying, hey, what place is Gary doing business with that only charges $5 for overdraft? Because what the CFPB found is that those fees can run usually in the $25 to $35 range. So if you're only getting charged $5 in overdraft, you actually have a pretty good deal.
Well, before it was about $20 or $25 before I signed up for the for the overdraft protection.
Was there a cost to sign up for it?
I don't think there was, no.
Okay, check into that, because if you are only being paid charged $5 for each overdraft, you actually have a pretty good deal.
So even though I have overdraft protection coverage, I still have to pay a fee.
When you make an overdraft, yes.
Oh, okay.
All right, Gary, thanks for that. And sometimes the facts of life are difficult to accept, you know. I mean, because it sounds like overdraft protection should be just that. But, again, you got to read the rules, right?
I'm so glad you elaborated on that, because I just got the Facts of Life TV show theme song in my head, and I kind of got distracted there for a minute. So, yeah,
so it's
you're
an
right.
earworm, and it's not going to let you go. We'll see if we can replace that with something else. We'll take a break, and we will return. So stick around. Kevin McKinley and On Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do you feel this vehicle is safe for highway travel?
Yes, I do. Yes, I really do. I believe that. I know it's not pretty to look at, but it'll get you where you want to go.
Now, you got no outside mirror.
No, we lost that.
You have no functioning gauges.
No, not a one. However, the radio still works. Funny as that may seem, with all this mess, that the radio is the only thing that's really working good, and it's as clear as a bell. Don't ask me how.
I got to tell you, I owned that car, but I have a confession that the radio really didn't. Well, it worked out of one speaker, so I guess that counts. Gene Purcell back with Kevin McKinley, and hopefully your car is not in that kind of need of repair. But we're talking about car conversations today about how to save money. We're taking some looks at how you can save on the cost of driving today, one that is no fun. And we are talking about what? Car maintenance?
Yes, sir. Service and maintenance. According to the good people at AAA, the Your Driving Cost Survey, we spend about 5 cents a mile on average every single year just on this boring maintenance, or worse yet, maintenance that's surprising and exciting, but needs to be paid for. And it's not too bad. At 15,000 miles a year, that's $750 a year. But it always seems like you just put a bunch of money into the car, and now something else goes wrong with it, too. And that, of course, rises. The maintenance cost rises as the value of the car falls. And so we have some good news and bad news on what you need to monitor and update and what you don't, and a good tip for kind of managing the expectations and unpleasant surprises.
Well, let's start with the good news.
Yeah, the good news is if you're changing your mile, or you're changing your oil every 3,000 miles, you can stop. According to many experts, including the people who wrote the manual in your glove box there underneath all the ketchup packets from the fast food company, they say that you can get by from anywhere from 5,000 to 7,500 miles between oil changes. And again, if you don't believe us, check the owner's manual. It's pretty sure the manufacturer is going to say that you can indeed get that far before you have to change the oil.
Well, wherever there's good news, I know there's bad news.
Yes, there is. You don't have to change the oil as often, but you should still bring your car into the mechanic at least every 6 months or so for a checkup and regular maintenance. With the money that you're saving on oil changes, you can spend more on upkeep. And when you are doing that, try to put the receipts every single time into a file in the car or that glove box, because not only documents any problems you might have, reoccurring problems with the service, especially if you take it to some other place, but also prove that you have a good history of maintenance if and when you go to sell the car.
And speaking of upkeep, where's the best way to spend that money on upkeep?
There are lots of little expenses that can lead to big problems if they are left unaddressed. Air filters, the battery, brake pads. Anytime you hear any squeak at all in those brake pads, you've got trouble and you need to get it replaced right away. The fluid levels throughout the entire automobile. The wipers, you know, this is a 50-cent to $5 proposition of changing those wipers. But if you can't see, especially during the wintertime, it can be extremely dangerous. And then finally, we mentioned it before, better to err on the side of caution and replace your tires a little bit before you absolutely need to rather than after it's too late.
We've been talking about a lot of the guts of the car, but what about the non-mechanical things?
This is a good point because it not only helps the value of the car, but it also can make it more enjoyable to drive around if the car is nice and clean and well-maintained on the outside. So definitely get it washed regularly, get it waxed, and keep and any little dings whatsoever in the surface of the exterior, get those fixed as quickly as possible. Your insurance might cover it, and even if it doesn't, it's worth it to pay cash for it but to prevent a bigger problem from spreading and also to keep from rust getting up there and really hurting the car. Clean the interior out, not just in terms of vacuuming, but, you know, especially in the springtime after you've been getting out of the car, you get sand on your shoes or your boots, and you get a lot of sand in the vehicle. Have the car detailed, meaning taking it to a place where you leave it for a day or two, and they just go over every nook and cranny. It costs about $100 or so, but, man, it's just a it feels so nice to get into a nice, clean car like that, and it will, of course, hold the value better eventually when you do go to sell it.
Now, you mentioned this earlier, but things just happen to cars sometimes. So how do we deal with that unpredictable nature of car maintenance and repair?
Well, first of all, throw a good roadside repair kit, jumper cables, flashing lights, a toolkit, whatever. Make sure you know how to change a tire. But more importantly, from a financial standpoint, save a regular amount every single month into a specified isolated account. Let's say it's $250. Use that to pay for the repairs and say, this is my repair car account. And as it builds up, you find that, say, well, it's not as shocking and damaging because I already have money set aside for it. And if the account is gone, meaning you've spent all of your money on repairs, it's probably time to buy a new one. And if you can afford it, you can use that $250 or whatever you were saving every single month to be a payment for a loan on a new car. Or if you haven't been making any repairs and exhausting that account, you can use the accumulated funds to pay cash for a new car. And between what you've accumulated there and your old car, which hasn't had any recent repairs and is good shape, you can probably afford a pretty nice newer one or even a used one if you want.
And finally, if I have a radio, do I really need two speakers or can I get by with one?
No, you can just get by one. And again, as we get a little older, hearing goes out in various years, I find that I don't even use one of those speakers anyway. So I'm okay with that.
All right, 800-642-1234. If you're listening on one speaker this morning, 800-642-1234. If you would like to join in, if you've got a question for Kevin or a comment. And don't forget, you can send email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's head back to the phones, and Mark starts us off. Mark is in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. Kevin, my question has to do with an inheritance that I'm going to be getting in another month or two, maybe $225,000. Is there some place I can just put that, keep the principal safe, and earn something from it? What would you recommend, please?
Yeah, I like this notion, especially when it is kind of a windfall of money and it is a very volatile time in the investment world. Letting it just sit is okay. It's okay to do nothing with it as long as it's safe and as long as it's accessible to you. And to those ends, I would do two things. One is I would go out and find a CD that has a very long maturity and a very low substantial penalty for early withdrawal. And typically, Mark, that's going to be maybe 6 to 12 months. And right now you can find some out there, 5-year CDs that pay like 1.75%. There's a 10-year CD we've talked about at Discover that pays 1.9%. And those have preset penalties. So if you do pull the money out early, you might pay 6 months or a year's worth of interest if and when you do pull it out. So they're safe. And because that dollar amount you're referring to is below the $250,000 limit, you're not going to worry about if the institution should get in trouble. It's still insured by the government. And the second thing I would look at is Series I savings bonds. You can put $10,000 per person per year into those. They don't pay a whole lot, but you can generally get the money out after 12 months with just a 3-month penalty for withdrawal, and after 5 years in there, there is no penalty for pulling the money out whatsoever. And those Series I savings bonds, the rate goes up and down every May 1st and November 1st. So if rates do rise and you don't feel like taking it out, you'll find that the rates on those Series I bonds will probably rise as well.
Mark, thanks for the call. And so, Kevin, you're not too worried about inflation in the short term, it sounds like.
Well, I'd like to see it, actually. It would be good for a lot of different things to see a little inflation. It would mean that the economy is doing better than what I think it actually is. And even if there is inflation and therefore are rising interest rates, because you've already established you can pull that CD out with a little or no penalty, you're not going to be hurt too bad. But in the meantime, you're going to be getting a better interest rate than what we're getting on very short-term deposits.
All right. Let's head back to Green Bay right now. And John is with us. Hi.
Good morning. Kevin, on past shows, you've advised retirees on of how much of their money they can spend without going broke before the end of their normal life expectancy. The formula that you had given included things like normal monthly expenses, income like pensions and Social Security, and savings that folks might have. Would you be able to go over that formula again?
Sure. It's a good question, and it's one I don't mind repeating at all because it's very important. And I found out, Gene and John, that not every person listens to every single show we put on. I was a little surprised to hear that.
You have to be kidding me.
No, I don't know what we're going to do about that. We need the show on 8 to 12 times a week.
Another illusion has been shattered.
As a rule of thumb, you can generally take your secure payments, like a Social Security and a pension, and subtract those from your monthly expenses, and the remainder should be multiplied by 200. That's how much money you need to retire comfortably. So if you're spending $5,000 per month and you're getting, let's say, $2,000 from Social Security and pension every month, that leaves $3,000 that needs to be covered. Times 200 is $600,000 that you need, preferably in liquid assets, although depending on the situation, I may be willing to include home equity or other kinds of real estate in there. Now, from a standpoint of saying, well, what can I spend of my assets, about 0.25% per month. So if you have $100,000, I feel comfortable saying, especially in your 60s, you can spend about $250 per month of that $100,000. If in your 70s, you can probably go to 0.5%, and in your 80s, 1% and beyond. And again, that's a fairly conservative return, and it assumes that you've got it invested safely enough where it won't drop by 50%, but also have a little bit of risk to it, so you are hopefully getting a higher overall long-term return. So again, you can spend about 1/200th of the assets every single month, or if you want a different ratio, spend about 0.25% to 0.5% every single month.
John, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Carrie is with us now from Rhinelander. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, in all the financial literature that I read or any of the TV shows that I watch, and your show included, everybody always expresses, you know, buy low-fee mutual funds or, you know, invest in low-fee Roth IRA accounts. Your last segment dealing with overdraft fees and non-sufficient fund fees are very easy to determine what's a high fee or a lower fee when it's in terms of $35 or $25 per transaction. But I don't have that same ability specifically with my Roth IRA accounts where I hold them at the brokerage firm or my children's 529 accounts. I have no idea as to what if they are low fee, and I have no idea how to determine that.
That's a great point, Carrie. And it's not only difficult to determine, but then it's hard to determine if what you have is competitive and or if it's worth the higher fee. And usually it's not. Most mutual fund managers out there charge more than they're worth. I've been an advisor for 25 years. I bought my first stock, 33 years ago. If I saw a place where just by giving the money to a smart mutual fund manager made a difference and they were better, I'd do that. And I still do have some managed funds that have higher expenses to it. But generally, we're better off trying to control expenses that we can control and know. And believe it or not, that information about your Roth IRAs and your 529s and the fees are disclosed to you. And it's buried in the prospectus. But if you ask the advisor or the provider, say, what are the annual expenses of this account? Typically, depending on the type of investment, about 0.5% or less is normal for a typical mutual fund, and it might be a little more expensive for a 529 account because there are some more administrative fees. But you can not only ask, but you can search for it. And if you go to a place like Morningstar or even just Google the mutual fund symbol, the first thing that will come up is a link to Google's finance page, which will tell you the expense ratio of a particular fund or investment.
Thank you very much.
Carrie, thanks for the call. Let's take a quick call from Jim, who joins us from River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I guess similar to your last caller, I'm wondering, I've heard that you're typically better off to put money into index funds where the fees are far less than other mutual funds. And over the long run, you know, if you're paying, I don't know what they are, 0.1%, that you tend to have a better outcome with those than more highly managed funds.
Absolutely. There's just been no difference where I've seen where over the long term that paying an individual to manage a particular mutual fund is worth paying 10 times more than it costs to get it, like a generic alternative, which is an index fund. An index means there's a preset pool of stocks and investments that it doesn't have someone deciding to what to buy and when to sell. And especially since I think we're going to be in a very low return environment going forward, if you're making 20% a year on your stock account, people don't care if you're paying an extra 1% or so of that of the overall account for management fees to the mutual fund company. But if you're only making 3 or 4% on the money and you're paying 1% for a mutual fund, that's a big chunk of your net worth. And if all they're getting is just shuffling around and there is a cheaper alternative, usually the index funds are a better way to go.
We've got an email here from Cheryl who wonders, what are TIPS, Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities, and for whom are they most appropriate?
That's funny, because I see, often when I buy coffee, I go to the coffee shop and I see a little jar that says TIPS on it, and that's not what I've been putting in there.
So interesting.
I should rethink that. I apologize to all the baristas.
Sounds like you could use a financial
advisor. I really could, finally. TIPS are Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and they are Treasury bonds guaranteed by the United States government. And the interest rate goes up and down with a benchmark that's tied to the consumer price index, basically. Now, the problem with these, of course, is that when inflation is very low, so is the yield. And these are a nice component to put into a bond portfolio, but they're not perfectly safe, meaning even if inflation or interest rates rise or the demand for these TIPS falls, so can the price of the bond. So you can lose money on these and the value can decline, but I'd rather have smaller investors use Series I savings bonds because the principal is safer.
All right, and thanks for that question. Is this something, though, that's becoming more popular? Is this something that people are asking you about quite a bit?
Well, they're afraid of it because when interest rates go down, everyone assumes that interest rates must go up, and the more likely they go down, the more likely they are to go up. We've been battling this for 3 decades now, and we still haven't seen it, in part due lately to Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve. He has mentioned something called tapering, which means they may stop buying as much bonds as they've been buying every single month for the Federal Reserve, which may mean higher interest rates. But again, if you protect yourself by using more CDs, money market accounts, treasuries, and Series I savings bonds, if interest rates do rise and inflation goes up, you won't be hurt as badly and you'll still have your money to invest at the higher rate.
All right, Kevin, it is time for our website of the week. What you got for us?
Safercar.gov. Safercar.gov is a government-sponsored website that tells you not only if a particular vehicle, make, and model has had problems in the past, but also if yours has had recalls that you haven't attended that can hurt you when you go to sell it. And oftentimes the recalls are free, and so you might as well get the repairs done now. Go to safercar.gov, and we'll have this website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And finally, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
All right. Terrific. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Gene.
Ben, great time. Kevin McKinley on Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Dean Kallenbach will be on the air hosting tomorrow. He'll be talking about a recent Census Bureau report showing that America's racial and ethnic minorities now make up about half of the 5 and younger age group. That's coming up tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For today, I'm Gene Purcell. I've been in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.